And Paul, thank you so much for being here.
It's a pleasure once again to be here with the folks from the Raven, well, hosted by the Raven Foundation. Good to be here. I haven't done it in a little while.
Yeah, it's been, we used to do it under Teaching Nonviolent Atonement, and we would talk about the Girardian lectionary, which I hear is having some pretty big changes happening.
Yes, I think we're switching over to WordPress in a format where the bottom of every page is going to have a way to have conversation to make it a little more interactive. It'll certainly have a different look to it. So, yeah.
Awesome. Well, I'm looking forward to that and talking with you a little bit more about it as well. So you've got a couple of things up in the air. You're a very busy man. You are the contributing theologian at Theology and Peace. You are the brain and energy behind the Girardian Lectionary at girardianlectionary.net. And you've just started this great program called Discipleship Seminars in Mimetic Theory. And that's just, I can't wait to talk to you about all of these things. So this week is Thanksgiving week. One of the difficult things about Thanksgiving that often happens is when we lose loved ones and we're here with family, and not everyone is there to be there with us. But we also want this it's during a time of thankfulness. And this is especially hitting us in the Girardian community because we just lost Rene Girard.
Yeah, it's one of, I've appreciated that Raven has put up a page, and I linked to it from my website, just all the different people who have come out and written and found some ways to give thanks for Renee's life, because I've had a hard time doing that. One of the ones that you posted yesterday, Matthew DiStefano, is that how you say his name?
Yes.
Okay. I haven't met him yet. I'd like to. But, you know, he told it in a very personal way in the one that you posted yesterday, and that he, too, was having trouble putting it in words. And one of the processes he had was being able to actually go to the memorial service, which I appreciated very much, because I, you know, for several years now, I've thought, well, when Rene dies, do I try to make the trip all the way from Michigan here to get out to that? And I was kind of watching for the for when the memorial service would be, and as it turned out, it was the same day as my nephew's wedding, so it didn't work out. But I think Matt being able to go to the memorial service and really find a way to get the grief started, it's been a little difficult. And compounding for me, this is, you know, you've kind of highlighted a year of change for me in transition. Well, it all started earlier this year with my own father's illness, and then he died at the end of March, and his funeral was in April. So when Rene died, on my mom and dad's anniversary, by the way, on November 4th, but they're both gone now, but it felt like losing a second father in a matter of months. So it's the grief part and the transitions I've been going through have slowed me down a little bit in terms of talking about that. So I appreciate the opportunity to say a little bit about that now. I mean, I've done it in the past, and many folks have tell their encounter with Renee's work in terms of a story of conversion, and I've told that before. I have met Renee personally, but I didn't really have a whole lot of chance to interact with them very much. I always felt it an honor and kind of, you know, very much a student-teacher relationship, or in some ways a father-son. And with a lot of admiration on my side. So one of the things that stands out for me, and it's a lot of the stories that people have told in the last couple of weeks, is, you know, Renee expressing admiration for your work, and being such an encouraging person. And that will always be a big memory for me. I think it was maybe 98, 99, somewhere in there. I think it was the Atlanta Cover Conference, where I actually brought Things Hidden with me to get him to sign it, you know, kind of the fan sort of relationship.
Yeah.
And as he took the book, he thanked me for my website and the work I'm doing with my lectionary, and was very encouraging with it. And it's one of those things where it's like, wow, he knows who I am. that's a very typical sort of story that I've appreciated people telling over the last few weeks, of how encouraging he was for folks, and, you know, a humble person. And I think he had a pretty good idea of how impactful his ideas are. Well, you know, Matthew in his column yesterday wasn't bashful or shy to say, you know, on the stage of world history. And I really do believe, along with Matthew, that this will be like a Darwinian revolution in the human sciences, because his mimetic theory just helps pull together so many different questions and problems and so much data elegantly from the human sciences. It's just an amazing thing. And more people are beginning to see that and recognize it from their own disciplines. And yeah, my encounters with Renee have been by and large at cover conferences and that sort of thing. And I also could relate to Matthew's story as well about going to Renee's house. Because he had everyone over to his house for dinner after the 1996 cover conference in Stanford. That conference ended at his house. And, you know, gee, how many years ago is that? That's going on almost 20 years ago. So my older children were still like elementary school age at that point. And, you know, for my wife and I both to get away, that was kind of rare, but we did in this case for that conference. And I remember asking permission from Martha Gerard to use their phone to call home to make sure the kids were okay. But just very, very down to earth folks, and so kind. So a lot of personal things like that. But then, of course, over the last 25 years, his mimetic theory has just changed the way it's changed my experience as a human being, to how I see the world and how I see who I am and who we are as a species.
Yeah, tell me more about that and how how it has changed basically everything for you.
Well, I was thinking about that a little bit this morning. Part of my transition, I've semi-retired from being a parish pastor after 30 years. As I was thinking about transitions, I come to learn that it was 30 years ago that I was ordained. And in our church, either 30 years experience or age 60, you can officially retire. So I've gone ahead and done that. But in making that move, part of it, as a parish pastor, there's so many wonderful things. The privilege of being part of people's lives, especially times of joy, like births and baptisms and marriages, and also times of illness and loss. And there's so many things about being a pastor that are wonderful and a privilege. After 30 years, it can get a little wearisome. But then one of the things that I found is that as my faith changed, especially over the last 25 years with mimetic theory, the things I was most passionate about as a disciple and a person of faith, it felt like the parish ministry was getting in the way, unfortunately.
Wow.
You know, that a lot of being a parish pastor is still about the maintenance of the organization. And you're still spending so much time on maintenance of the organization that some of the things I'd love to do, wasn't getting a chance to do as much anymore. So as I've retired, the first thing that I've done is revitalize my connections with a lot of peace and justice ministries here in Kalamazoo. Mm-hmm. And this morning, I happened to be at a very well-run, well-done summit on racism here in Kalamazoo. And, you know, thinking about this coming up this afternoon, and then also some of the things we were talking about. Yeah, one of the questions we were discussing in our small groups was, what are the barriers to collaboration? And it occurred to me that big picture is that our dominant culture is so geared into individualism that it almost, well, it does work against collaboration very often. And so one of the things that I think is huge about mimetic theory and the paradigm shift is that it really is trying to transform our way of looking at ourselves as human beings against the dominant view right now in our culture, which is so individualistically oriented. So, you know, in terms of Girard's psychology, early on, he adopted with his friend Jean-Michel Gorlian, we're not individuals, we are interdividuals. That's how dramatic a shift this is. To be able to see ourselves in a very different way, that we truly are not individuals. And then the whole, all the stuff of individualism that's celebrated in our culture and way of looking at things. So
it goes so much against our modern concept,
right?
Enlightenment concept. Can you, why is that so important for us to move beyond and to get into this interdividuality that Renee is talking about? What's so significant about that?
Well, I think there's a number of reasons. What is just the truth?
Yeah.
to be in pursuit of the truth of who we truly are as a species. One of the things that the mirror neurons and the neuroscience does now is say that as a species, we are hardwired to be social. our hard wiring of our brain ties us into one another in such wonderful ways that to think of ourselves and to see ourselves as individuals is just false. And, you know, it's even in terms of the spirituality, say out of a Thomas Merton, and sometimes someone like Richard Rohr uses it too, false self, true self. Mm-hmm. And, you know, to see ourselves as individuals is just really a false sense of who we are.
Mm-hmm.
So one thing is in terms of in a pursuit of truth and understanding who we are, we are interdividuals. We are not individuals. But then so many of the problems we're encountering right now in terms of inequality and violence and many, many of the ways that we are now sacrificial in our modern contemporary Western cultures, individualism feeds right into that. And trying to understand that dimension of it too, that individualism feeds into that sacrifice, our way of doing sacrifice in the modern world.
Wow. I know you've done a lot on economic justice, which is one of the themes that you are dealing with and teaching in the discipleship seminars in mimetic theory. Economic justice is one of the important things that we need to deal with, and is on this individualism that you are talking about. And I'm wondering how we can work towards a more just economic system using mimetic theory.
Well, that, you know, that's a big question, because some of it is going to have to be on that theoretical level of just understanding. I think one of the, as Girardians write on economics, for instance, André Orléans' book on the Empire of Value, is that right?
That sounds right. Yeah.
I'm drawing a blank on the title. But anyways, I think one of his main theses about capitalism is works pretty well as a prescriptive science, as laying out a way of doing economics which is productive, and it does have some major positives when we follow capitalism prescriptively. But one of the things I think I hear him saying in that book is that as a descriptive science, it's a failure. It just really does not understand clearly enough who we are as human beings. And so at times of crisis, the prescriptive element of capitalism falls apart. People panic into not following it prescriptively anymore. And because it's descriptively inaccurate and false in many crucial ways, we get into serious crises, like the Great Depression and more recently in 2008, where we have a near collapse of our banking system, if not for some crucial interventions from government.
Do you think that's the solution, is interventions from our government into?
Well, I think even those kinds of things, mimetic theory can help us understand the appropriate and proper roles of government at times like that. But I think overall, the mimetic theory can just help us understand who we are as human beings in a way in which we can begin to conceive of our economics in some crucially different ways that perhaps go along better with who we are as a species. And again, that I would say that a big part of that is getting away from the individualism.
I have started reading Paul Dumichel's new book, The Barren Sacrifice, that you've been talking about on your Facebook page. And he's even more than in the ambivalence of scarcity, he's talking about the individualism behind the evolution of neglect. And I'm starting to see that in the sacred violence of the primitive sacred, it was a solidarity of society and a lack of individual sense that would tend to lead to the collective violence against the victim. And in modern times, it's almost a flip-flop in that you have a radical individualism, which therefore causes kind of a conspiracy of neglect. And he's been, you know, arguing in the early pages that I've read so far of in the Barren Sacrifice, how scapegoating, such as in the Nazi persecution of the Jews, feeds on the individualism of everybody who participates primarily through neglect, rather than being caught up in necessarily, I mean, there were people caught up in frenzies, but those frenzies are the context of neglect which allow the frenzies to happen. And so that the individualism has developed has kind of transformed collective violence, but it's still a mimetic process.
Yeah, that's Andrew Marr. Thank you very much for that. Paul, do you have a response to what Andrew just said?
Yeah, Dumichel's works, I finished The Ambiguity of Scarcity, and I'm also plowing through The Barren Sacrifice and agree with Andrew. And I find it a very meaningful way to tie into discipleship and Christian faith too, because what Dumichel is talking about is that in archaic societies, solidarity obligations were built into the fabric of the system, into the tribal institutions and way of life, so that, you know, no one went hungry unless everyone went hungry. And at that point of scarcity, they didn't really have an experience of scarcity, because if it got to the point where they lacked food, so that there was the threat of everyone going hungry, what they experienced was the breakdown of their community and dissolved in intertribal, intercommunity violence. And so the key thing is to understand that the solidarity obligations, you know, the gods commanded you to do that, to make sure that everyone in your tribe was taken care of. And if you didn't do that, there were dire consequences, because it was still a sacrificial culture. And the irony is that in our modern situation, after the gospel, the effect of the gospel is to whittle away the obligation part, the sacrificial part of obligation. And feeling law in that sense is called into question by the gospel. Now, what the gospel also does is really highlight solidarity, but that solidarity as something that is fulfilled in love and compassion. Solidarity becomes something we do because we can become creatures of love and compassion. And so solidarity becomes fulfilled in a non-legalistic sense. You know, that's what I'm hearing more and more these days when the New Testament talks about the law being fulfilled in love. We can now be the kind of creature who lives in solidarity with God's creation out of love and compassion. And solidarity becomes a law or an obligation that's fulfilled in freedom rather than a sacrificial threat. The threat of sacred violence. And what has happened, though, over the last 2,000 years, according to Dumas Chao, which is really important, is we've whittled away the obligation part without replacing it with love and compassion. So the solidarity goes away, too. Solidarity becomes a personal choice in an individualistic culture. I can choose to be in solidarity with this community or that community, or if I'm really a great person, I can choose to be in solidarity with everyone. But it's a choice. It's not built into the system. So unfortunately, there are loads and loads of other people who are choosing not to live in solidarity with anyone. And so the thing that ends up being institutional or cultural is the choice of indifference. Indifference is the default mode. And I can choose as a charitable person to be compassionate and in solidarity with somebody. But the default mode is indifference. And so our sacred violence takes the form of neglect.
That's...
I think of Michel Serre, that memorable speech at the Ghost Ranch, explained how Christianity brought in an individualism, particularly through the conversion of St. Paul, which was taking responsibility for removing oneself from the frenzy of the primitive sacred, so as to undermine the primitive sacred. But the other thing is that the anthropology in the New Testament, the new person of St. Paul, especially in the metaphors of the church, is something I'm working with right now in a book on charity and spirituality I'm working on right now. Are images that are, in fact, individual, so that the personal responsibility through Paul's conversion that we can participate in through baptism is also for the purpose of being like living stones, which is a very social image, where an isolated individual person is not what the gospel is looking for, but it is the new person is indeed individual as far as the New Testament teaching is concerned. And that's the part we seem to keep missing as the secular world keeps accentuating the individualism. At least.
Yeah, one image, and you'll see it if you go to my new webpage, Discipleship Seminars. I have a photo of a grove of aspen trees. And for me, that's become a helpful and meaningful image because as we understand it now, aspen trees they look like individual trees from the surface, but we've discovered that a grove of aspen trees are actually all interconnected by their root system, and that the new aspen trees in a grove are actually an outgrowth from the other trees. So there is a
their
sense,
roots are connected. Is that right?
Right. Their roots are all interconnected, and I guess there's one. What's the name of it? I think it's called like the panda or something like that. It's a huge and ancient grove of aspen trees in New Mexico, which is considered the largest single organism in the world. It's a very large grove of old aspen trees. But when you look at the trees from, you know, above ground, they appear as individual trees, and they're not. It's all one tree with growing out of a single root system. And I think that mimetic theory is showing us a similar reality about who we are, that our mirror neurons interconnect us so much interpersonally that we appear as individuals, but subconsciously we're actually all tied together. That our sense of self is really given to us through other people. And one of the most powerful things, I think, in the Girardian corpus is just like a two-page section in the first chapter of the Genesis of Desire by Hugo Leon about the dying and rising of self. We began talking about our loss of Renee when, and of course, on a day-to-day level, it's even more crucial for something like a spouse. You live together with a person for 40 years, for 50 years, in a close relationship like that. And when they die, yourself dies, because who your self has become so intertwined with that other person that yourself basically dies and needs to be reborn on a day-to-day level, living without that person in the flesh close by in your life anymore. And it's that way with all our transitions. I mean, I'm looking forward to many positive steps moving away from parish ministry. But, you know, in the last few months, as I am not a parish pastor anymore, there are times when I feel like, who the hell am I? Because my whole sense of self is in transition right now, you know, moving away from being intertwined in the lives of people in a parish the way I have been in the last 30 years. So that's how big of a paradigm shift is required to be able to be understand ourselves as thoroughly social being, the most social creature on the earth in terms of the ways in which we are tied into one another.
Yeah, one of the things that I think is so crucial about this, and you were talking about the law of love earlier, and one of the things that I find so crucial about this is that Renee is always saying we receive our identity from the other, and receiving our identity from people that we love and that hold us up is a great, healthy thing. But we also receive our identity from our enemies, from those we're in a violent relationship of reciprocity with.
When we get into a stumbling block or scandal on relationship with another person or a group of people, we begin to resemble each other more and more. And we're always trying to focus on the differences, when for René it was always the similarities that, or really from an objective standpoint or a third party looking on to a relationship like that, the similarities are what can be striking, because as you say, we're receiving our identities from one another. And when we get trapped in a negative reciprocity with someone, it goes into a negative downward spiral.
So I think we're seeing this on a national level with our fight against ISIS.
Right.
So ISIS is clearly violently killing, excluding people, and causing them to seek refuge in other countries, recently, including the United States. And recently, governors in the United States, as I'm sure you've heard, have been saying, no, we don't want them. So we are excluding refugees, basically mirroring the same hostility towards these immigrants that ISIS is having. And we're becoming these enemy twins, doing the same acts of exclusion and violence against one another. And it's easy to see that dynamic working once you have mimetic theory. And you can reflect on that if you'd like. But the question, the bigger question that I have, you have this, your discipleship seminars, the tagline is equipping disciples to engage in the politics of justice. So the basic question is, as we're fighting for justice in racism against ISIS, in economic justice, how do we get out of the pattern of reflecting the hostility of those people that we call our enemies?
You know, that was the very first sentence of Walter Wink's great book, Two, Engaging the Powers. Excuse me, I think he just said it very simply. And of course, at that point, he was also already a reader of Girard too, but he posed it as, how can we stand up against evil without becoming evil ourselves? And that's always a challenge. A discipleship and following Jesus that is always compassionate. And of course, for Jesus, he didn't necessarily have to do it from the standpoint of also being a fellow sinner with the person you're standing against, as the rest of us do. Hopefully that keeps us humble. That was always a very important theme for someone like Gandhi and Martin Luther King Jr. as well, to remain humble as fellow sinners. And you know, the mimetic theory can help us be aware of the ways in which we follow each other down a rabbit hole of violence, and hopefully help us put the brakes on that kind of thing. I'm more and more convinced that it takes a spirituality somehow grounded in compassion. You know, whether you do it as a Christian, being grounded in the compassion of Christ, or a Buddhist, or you know, Dan Harris in his book 10% Happier practices at least 5 minutes of contemplative prayer or meditation a day, and he's almost antithetical to religion, but did learn a Buddhist technique of prayer to help ground him in compassion. So at this point, even a non-religious secular person can engage in spiritual practices which focus on compassion for the other person. And I think that has to be a non-negotiable part. It's just It's not going to work without that.
Compassion for even those people that we call our enemies. And that's, I think, what is so crucial in this fight for justice, because it's so easy to demonize our enemies. And when you start talking about having compassion for people like ISIS, you are deemed crazy, nuts, anti-American. So this is like reminded that that's what Jesus was called to, and this is a very risky way of life.
Well, I think it's difficult even with mimetic theory in tow. I think in the last week reading Michael Kerwin's article that someone posted on one of our Gerard sites, I think it was his, that talking about what you referred to just a few minutes ago of how we can come to resemble each other more and more as we engage one another violently. And he just made the blanket statement at one point, I think, that those who fight the terrorists, their violence is really no different. And right away, the American, the patriot in me wants to jump in and say, no, that's not right. You know, how can you say that a suicide bomber is not different? Well, yeah, I mean, the vehicle of the violence is different, but the indiscriminate ways in which it kills is not that different. On NPR, they did an interview the other morning with a woman who has just immigrated from Syria. She finally left because in the retribution bombing by the Soviet Union and others on Syrian targets for ISIS right now, her home was blown up. She barely got out alive. So the whole laughable thing of smart bombs back in the original Gulf War, and then the on shock of trying to get into the Iran war, we just have to be more honest about the fact that our violence ends up having the same kind of effect. When you're using this kind of lethal weaponry and violence, civilians die. We have to be more willing to recognize that in taking a war against terrorists who indiscriminately kill civilians, we end up doing the same thing.
Yeah, my colleague Lindsay Paris Lopez keeps bringing up the drone papers,
right?
Which says that 90% of drone attacks don't hit the intended targets, and so causing damages to homes and civilians. And what greater recruiting tool does a group like ISIS have than our own drones, our own violence?
Right.
It's just part of the whole cycle of violence that we keep seeing, and it's also the individualism that you have been pointing to. And we're not seeing how all of this is connected, because we're social creatures. And so what is the solution to all of this?
So many of the wonderful columns written remembering Rene and celebrating his work in the last few weeks, that apocalyptic element comes out and becomes so important too. Why do I care about this stuff? Because the world is in a real dangerous place right now. And we, in terms of, was it Kerwin's paper again that refers several times to Zizek's Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse? You know, he names it as economic inequality, global warming, and the degradation of our ecosphere. And I, you know, I'm like a good Republican candidate right now. I can't name the other two. But,
I forgot like that. Yeah.
So, but these stated again to one a passage that continually comes back for me that I think was very important to Jesus and his ministry was the end of the call to Isaiah in Isaiah 6. And with the cherubim and the seraphim and the hot coals and here I am, send me. We know that part really well. The part we often don't know as well is the really important part that comes after it, where God says, yeah, and give them a message that they won't hear and understand. And Isaiah says, how long, O Lord? And he says, until the cities are lay waste. And, you know, the prophetic dimension of Jesus' ministry is one of these days where maybe we'll finally hear that message and it'll sink in and we'll be able to be the human creatures that God made us to be from the beginning, where our solidarity with one another and with the rest of the creation is fulfilled. We're able to live in God's compassion and love and grace. You know, how that all happens, you know, this is the task of discipleship.
That's a beautiful way to end it, to become truly human and enter the path of discipleship. So thank you for that, Paul. If people are interested in your discipleship seminars, how can they get in contact with you?
Yeah, I the scary part of this new venture is I'm subtracting a pretty significant part of our family income. So, yeah. So I'm, this is a labor of love truly, but, I'm going to need to try to, I'd love to get out to many different communities. It's going to be my way of life here coming up. I have, the first two that I'm talking to, two groups of Lutherans, one in Red Wing, Minnesota, and one in La Crosse, Wisconsin, and drop me an email or go to my website, discipleshipseminars-mt.net. And I'd love to come to your community and talk to folks about the importance that mimetic theory has to help us turn this paradigm around from individualism to solidarity, which happens again in a lot of different ways. I think mimetic theory, it's in the theory to help us understand and see these things in new ways, but Pope Francis is sure talking a good solidarity theology and message, as are many, many other disciples in lots of different ways. So,
yeah, our friend and your fellow Lutheran pastor, Tim Seitz Brown, keeps bringing up Ubuntu, which is the ancient African phrase of I am because we are. This great solidarity that you find in every tradition. Thank you so much for the conversation, Paul. It's always a blessing for me to see you and talk with you. I always learn so much. So thank you for being here.
Thank you for the invitation and opportunity to chat with some friends here.
Okay, until next time, peace be with you.
And with you.